it's always a blessing to be gathered around the table of the Lord with all of you brethren. I want to mention my phones. Their batteries are getting weaker these days. I may have to take a moment to call back on another phone in the middle of this. We'll see. Hope not. We'll see. And I had the next Roman study all ready to go last week. But then the meeting last Sunday kind of, I guess you could say, inspired me to want to look into Matthew 23, 24, and 25. So I changed the whole thing, and we're doing that. And it's of necessity going to be in a number of parts. It's a big study. So we'll see how it goes, brethren. For Matthew 24, we're going to apply the same contextual Bible study principles we've been using for Hebrews and Romans. And when we do that, we find it is actually one of the easiest chapters in the Bible to understand. But first, a little history, which we find in the reprints and in a very good book about the history of Jehovah's Witnesses, Apocalypse Delayed. Brother Russell came across a group of brethren. This included George Storrs, who in his magazine Bible Examiner taught the truth about hell and restitution. It is Brother Russell's association with this group that he learned fundamental Bible truths. At that time, there was also a group of former Adventists, a number of whom had been disappointed by Jesus not returning in 1844. They reworked Miller's chronology and time prophecies and came up with a new date, 1874. William Miller rejected the new date, having been disappointed three times. That was enough for him. Their new date failed as well. But then a group of diehard Adventists discovered a translation that used presence instead of coming, and on that basis rescued their new date by saying their date was right, but what they expected was wrong. The return was really invisible. Brother Russell wound up having a special weekend of study with two of the most prominent of these brethren, Brother Peyton and Brother Barber. They convinced Brother Russell of their new time configurations, and Brother Russell, in exchange, shared with them the truth he knew at that time about the divine plan. Brother Russell financed a book combining the truth about restitution with the time prophecies. A portion of the new time prophecies included what we call the parallels, which taught there would be a 40-year harvest. This idea so energized Brother Russell that he believed he must give up his profession and devote himself to spreading the truth that the last members of the church could be gathered within the 40 years. This is very important. It is through the work of Brother Russell and the overruling providences of the Lord that a movement was begun that spread through much of the world. That movement is responsible for the 6 volumes of scripture studies that outline Bible truths that until that time, while known, never received the kind of proclamation they did through the work of Brother Russell. There is no question that all of us rejoicing in the truth can trace back one way or another, our understanding to the ministry of Brother Russell. And here's the important point. Brother Russell was motivated to do this great work because of an error, the 40-year harvest idea. What does this tell us about the workings of the Lord? Simply that God can overrule and bless for the good, even though there may be misunderstandings of his scriptures. Some make the unfortunate mistake of discarding or even denigrating Brother Russell because of what they consider to be his errors. We should note God not only didn't discard him, but blessed him richly, even to this very day, in the person of each of us who understand his plan through Pastor Russell's ministry. Undeniable fact. Let it be understood that the following study of Matthew 24 is not meant in any way to undermine Brother Russell or throw shade upon his work, nor those who have a different understanding of Jesus' prophecy, which is the great majority of brethren today. This will be rather a serious investigation of what Jesus said about this subject of his return, with an eye toward the concern that after 150 years, more and more questions are beginning to be asked. Before we begin, let's lay down a few rules regarding our study. First and foremost, we will consider seriously the words of Jesus himself. In doing that, we will not presume to recast his clear statements to mean the opposite of what he says in an effort to hold on to preconceived views. Nor will we quote the ideas of various brethren as if that's proof of anything. Secondly, while the subject is Matthew 24, the obsessive attention to this chapter can becloud some very important points. For example, Matthew 24 is just one account of this prophecy. There are two other full accounts of the same prophecy, one in Mark and one in Luke. To not take these into consideration by comparing and contrasting them is to expose ourselves to but one-third of the story. Only by bringing these into our study can we learn things that are not said or clearly explained in Matthew 24 alone. Now, Jesus, of course, knows more about his return than anybody, certainly any prophet. We will find that there is something completely unique about Jesus' presentation of the last days, something no other prophecy does. Jesus lays out the prophetic events in an exact and correct sequence. What makes the book of Revelation difficult is the prophetic events are not only sometimes symbolized, but are also out of order. We will observe the time sequence described by Jesus and not ignore it in order to fit a pattern of events we're more comfortable with. We will also do our section work, determining which verses belong to what overall subject. We'll do this so we don't take a verse out of context and apply it to a subject actually not under discussion. It so happens Matthew 24 is crystal clear as to its sections and subjects for one very simple reason. Jesus is answering several very specific questions. All we need do is group the verses together that answer any particular question. Well, that brings us to the beginning of our study. And I recommend we all open up to Matthew 23. We're going to begin by noting the real context in Matthew begins with chapter 23 and goes continuously through chapters 24 and 25. In Matthew 23, Jesus is condemning the Pharisees and pronouncing woes upon them. Matthew 23:36 says, "All these things shall come upon this generation." In Matthew 24:1 says, "Jesus went out and departed from the temple." So Matthew 23, the woes upon the Pharisees took place in the temple, as does Matthew 23:37-39. Now, before we clarify a translation, let's read the second half of Matthew 24:1. "And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple." The NIV in Mark 13:1 has them saying, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." Now, Jesus had been to the temple many times, no doubt with his disciples. What were they doing, pointing out the greatness of the temple to him, when he knew that fully well? Context, brother. Context, context, context. After casting the woes upon the Pharisees, after saying in Matthew 23:35-36, all the righteous bloodshed on earth would be required of that generation, he says in verse 38, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." The NEB gives a clear thought. Look, look, there is your temple forsaken by God. The word for house means temple and is so used in Matthew 21:13. It is written, "My house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves." Verse 12 makes clear this was in the temple. Desolate means, according to Strong's, waste. So Jesus is actually the first to tell his disciples, "You look at the temple." That's what "behold" actually means. Take a look at this. So he says, take a look at this magnificence. It is going to be laid waste. And this is confirmed by Jesus' words in Matthew 24:2. "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." That is Jesus' reply to the disciples after they pointed out to him the magnificence of the temple buildings, with the implication being, "Jesus, you can't mean all this is going to be destroyed." They were provoked to do that because he just said in Matthew 23:38, this would all be destroyed. Matthew 23:38, "Behold," or "look, your house is left unto you desolate," or waste. Now, brethren, I hope we're seeing how chapter 23 melds into and justifies and occasions chapter 24 and connects to it. Now, back to verse 39 in chapter 23. After saying the temple's going to be destroyed, Jesus says, I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So here's another surprising statement by Jesus. Not just the woes upon the Pharisees, not just the righteous blood of earth required of them in this generation, not just the temple destroyed, but another coming by Jesus, at which time those Pharisees who were now fully rejecting him would acknowledge him as coming in the name of the Lord. Now, why is this background important? Because without it, we can't understand the questions of Matthew 24:3. I recommend you scratch out the Matthew 24 and 25 chapter breaks. They destroy the narrative. Now, since we tend to spend all our time on Matthew 24, we have come to think there are only three questions asked by the disciples. This is not true. There are four, as we shall see. But let's outline the three questions in Matthew 24:3. 1. Tell us when shall these things be? 2. What shall be the sign of thy coming or presence? 3. What shall be the sign of the end of the world? Let's observe. The when question had to do with things plural. That would be all Jesus had just mentioned in chapter 23. When shall these things B. The sign question had to do with singular events, the presence and the end of the world. For the fourth question, we have to go to the Mark and Luke account of the questions. Mark 13:4. This is the dialogue. What will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Or the NIV. What will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled? RSV. What will be the sign when these things are all about to be accomplished? Luke puts it the same way as do other translations. Luke 21:7. Diaglot. What will be the sign when these things are about to be accomplished? Let it be noted that disciples asked about how they would know the things Jesus mentioned were, quote, about to be accomplished. They did not ask about a sign. They were in process of happening. It is very important that both Mark and Luke make clear the disciples were asking about these things, plural, Jesus had just mentioned, which included the destruction of the temple and his coming in the name of the Lord. Now, the real question is, were the disciples, as has been suggested, really asking, what shall be the signs of your invisible presence? Or were they asking, based upon what they had just heard Jesus say about his coming in the name of the Lord, what will be the sign that coming in the name of the Lord is about to be accomplished? Now, why could the disciples not ask a question about signs of an invisible presence? I want to ask that again. Why could the disciples not ask a question about signs of an invisible presence? The imposition upon the disciples that they were asking that question violates the entire gospel narrative. It assumes they knew Jesus would die and be resurrected a spirit being and return invisibly. In John 16:16-18, Jesus told his disciples he was going to his Father. And verse 18 has the disciples responding, "What is this? We cannot tell what he said." And we all know how devastated they all were when Jesus was crucified. They knew nothing whatsoever about his being resurrected a spirit being. We cannot, in order to justify our belief about an invisible return, ascribe to the disciples knowledge that we present-day Bible students want them to be saying, which is, what are the signs of your invisible presence? Because we won't be able to see a spirit being. As if they had full knowledge of his death and resurrection and return as a spirit being, which we know they didn't. Even after Jesus' resurrection, they had no comprehension whatsoever of an invisible return. In Acts 1:6, they asked him, "Wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel?" Nothing about a period of an invisible return. And there's another serious contextual problem or issue. Jesus had just said, moments before their questions, that his enemies would not see him again, quote, "till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord," Matthew 23:39. So if Jesus had just said his enemies are going to recognize and see him coming, why would his disciples a few moments later ask him how they, his friends, could discern a secret, invisible coming by signs? So what were they asking? They were asking what it says clearly in Mark and Luke. They were asking a sign of the nearness of the events he spoke about. And Jesus' answers to their questions conform totally to the idea they were asking about proximity of events, not their presence. Luke 21:7, NIV. What will be the sign that they are about to take place? Diaglot. What will be the sign when these things are about to be accomplished? We will find Jesus stays true to answering their questions as asked. They would not ask for a sign the events Jesus just mentioned were underway, for they could see that for themselves. Take the destruction of the temple, for instance, which they were asking about. Why would they ask for a sign of its destruction taking place when they could see that for themselves? Even as they would see Jesus coming in the name of the Lord as Jesus said the Pharisees would. They also wanted a win, and they wanted an indication of nearness, about to be accomplished. One of the events Jesus mentioned that were listed among these things the disciples wanted to know about was the destruction of the temple. Now, obviously, Jesus would not need to give them a sign that was happening, but he did give them a sign of it's about to be accomplished. But that answer is only in the Luke account. Luke 21:20. When ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation, what's he referring to? The temple is nigh. Remember, Jesus said the temple would be desolated. There it is. And the indication that it is near would be Jerusalem surrounded by armies. And history tells us there was first a surrounding and then a period of pause that actually gave believing Christians a chance to flee. Now, since our traditional understanding of what shall be the sign of thy presence is not permitted by the knowledge of the disciples at that time, it is easy to see from all references to these questions that they were about proximity. Nearness, not hearness. Proximity. Because once they were happening, there's no need for a sign. Now, parousia or parousia, whichever it is, can mean presence. It does not mean invisible presence. But if someone is present, that has to mean they've come. So if Jesus is recognized as having come in the name of the Lord, he's surely recognized as being present. The translator, Barclay, has a very good meaning of words book. And in it, he examines parousia. He says, quote, in the papyri and in Hellenistic Greek, parousia is the technical word for the arrival of an emperor, a king, a governor, or famous person into a town or province. Now, this fits nicely with Jesus' thought that when he does return, he will be recognized as of God. Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. By the way, in that remark by Jesus, there's nothing to suggest to his disciples that that coming will be secretive. Actually, quite the opposite. Now, Jesus answered the destruction of the temple question in Luke 21:20-24. It is not touched upon in Matthew 24. What is thoroughly answered is the end of the world question. Now it is, we divide up Matthew 24 into sections based upon Jesus' answers to their question. In verses 4 to 14, Jesus answers the end of the world question. So bracket that off and list above it, subject, end of the world. Verses 4 and 5 are a warning to not be deceived by false Christs. Verse 6 is important. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but The end is not yet. That is very important. Jesus is not describing a period we like to call the end of the age, as if it's a period of time. He is not saying here plentiful wars are a sign of the end of the age. He says the end is not yet. So the end is a definite event, and there are things that precede it. Verses 7 and 8. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Now, I recommend circling end in verse 6 and circling beginning in verse 8 so you can see the contrast. There is a specific end and there is a specific beginning. The word sorrows carries the idea of birth pangs. And we know from nature there is a beginning and end to those. Jesus is describing these difficult events as but the beginning of that which will pain the world before its end, not during its end. The Diaglot puts it, these are only the beginning of sorrows. So Jesus is presenting quite an outlook here as to the trials and tribulations in store for this world. Now, an important word. Then. It's a word that suggests both sequence and time. Verse 9, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. So at the time of the beginning of these birth pangs, there will come a persecution upon the church, and this is described in the prophecies of Daniel. Next in line, verse 10. Then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. Now we can see how that follows in sequence. Until the persecution, there's no need for the betrayals. Verse 11. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. So what have we got here? A time of great deception on the earth. Verse 12. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. This describes a time when evil takes over the earth. People of God betraying one another, and love of many vanishing. Jesus doesn't specify if that is the church only or includes all mankind. Now, verse 13. We now have an important word reappearing. But he that shall endure unto the end, same shall be saved. In Jesus' sequence of events here, the end has not yet arrived. This describes a great period of trial upon the people of God, requiring endurance in evil times. And Jesus also shows the end has not arrived. It's a period of trial. It also shows that his people will be on earth up to that end. Verse 14. Now we see this description by Jesus is absolutely sequential. One event leading to another in proper sequence. or piling atop one another. Here we go. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, can we see here Jesus has answered their question about the end of the world? He gives them a series of events in sequence that lead up to that end. And he gives the final event that takes place before the end, preaching of the gospel throughout the world. Now, this may very well align to Revelation 14, 6 and 7. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come. The fact that that takes place at the time of the day of judgment, it also places that preaching as just before the end of the current age or world, and that's what Jesus did. And then shall the end come, Jesus said. The end is a definite point in time. It is not a period of time. What Jesus describes is a period of time that leads up to the end. The end does not come until the gospel is preached in all the world. Now, that's the end of that. They also asked about how they would know his presence or parousia was about to be accomplished. Beginning in verse 15, Jesus will now do what he did with the end question. He will detail a series of events which will indicate the nearness of his return. And they will culminate with his coming in the name of the Lord. The next section begins with verse 15, ends in verse 31. When Jesus says in verse 30, they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So you can section those verses off. Make it clear. Previous to that verse, and beginning with verse 15, Jesus outlines events which we have attributed to signs of an invisible presence. But reading the context, just how it is he's come before verse 30, when he says he comes, is at best difficult to explain. Again, this section is very simple to mark out. It is Jesus' answer to the question about his presence. The first section was his answer to the question about the end of the world. As Jesus details in sequential order, beginning in verse 15, we find it is not until this series of events ends this section is very simple to mark out. It is Jesus' answer to the question about his presence. The first section was his answer to the questions about the end of the world. As Jesus details events in sequential order, beginning in verse 15, we find it is not until this series of events ends that he returns. Now, why do we say these events are in sequential order by Jesus? Verse 15, when? Verse 16, then? Verse 21, for then? Verse 23, then? Verse 29, immediately after, verse 30, and then, verse 30 again, and then. Now, lest we get a wrong idea about Jesus' return. Of course, he's not coming back human. or in human form. Nor will people see a human form of Jesus dangling from the sky. He says over and over how it will be manifested or its sign. Here's Acts 1, 9 to 11. You can look it up. Acts 1, 9 to 11. These are plain statements. Don't need interpretation. While they beheld, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. Is there any reason to believe that's symbolic? That was a literal cloud. It's a real cloud. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven." As ye have seen him go into heaven. No question they saw it. As ye have seen him go into heaven. They saw Jesus in a real cloud ascend into heaven. The Bible says he will return in like manner. And he will be seen in the same way, in a cloud. Luke 21, 27. Then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Matthew 26, 64. I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and coming in the clouds of heaven. Revelation 1:7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him. Throughout Revelation, he's pictured as on a cloud. 1 Thessalonians 4:14-17 presents a very important distinction, as well as a reference to these clouds. Even so also them which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this I say to you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not precede them which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds. Did we catch the distinction there? There are two groups being resurrected. When Jesus returns, it is first the dead in Christ, then it is we which are alive and remain, who are caught up in the cloud, signifying Jesus' return, to ever be with the Lord. There's nothing in these inspired words that says there's another group yet to be born and converted who will likewise be taken up to heaven in the cloud. Two groups only, those asleep, and those who are alive and remain on earth when Jesus returns. In Matthew 24:27, Jesus says, "As the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Now, the reason for Jesus saying that in the context, which we'll get into next time, it's basically just saying, don't be fooled by any idea that Jesus is hidden in secret chambers or the like and needs some human to reveal him. He will be as revealed as lightning lighting up the sky everywhere. Put these cloud scriptures together and it's very simple. The return of Jesus will be revealed in the power and glory of a display of heavenly clouds such as has never been seen before. Luke 21:27, coming in a cloud with power and great glory. That will indeed be a sight all eyes can see. Now, perhaps we've noticed up to this point, we've done our best to do no interpreting. We just tried to look at the plain statements of Jesus and accept them as such. We also tried to look at the biblical reality of what the disciples understood at the time of their questions in Matthew 24. They knew absolutely nothing about Jesus becoming an invisible spirit being. They didn't even know he was going to die. It was impossible for them to ask him for signs of an invisible presence. Now, before we start our next big section, which will really be next time, Lord willing, I want to address a few concerns that might be presenting themselves up to this point. One is, but don't the scriptures say Jesus returns as a thief, which means invisibly? You know, brethren, we've been told that so often for so long. Our minds actually accept that's what coming as a thief means. Now, this is going to come up later in the context of Matthew 24 and Mark and Luke. But let's deal directly with it now and quickly and thoroughly later. Coming as a thief is really an illustration or a picture meant to convey a truth to our minds. And you know, Jesus was very good at taking examples from nature and regular life to illustrate his point. I don't know that he ever violated nature or normal life to make an illustration. Wheat and tares, for example. Brethren, in nature, has there ever been an invisible thief? So in Jesus' day, when he said coming as a thief, no one would draw the conclusion he meant he would come invisibly. There'd be no basis for that. What would they know about thieves that would relate to what Jesus said continuously about his return? Didn't Jesus insist not even angels knew when he would return, let alone his followers? So what can we learn, very simply, from the thief illustration? It's very simple. No thief ever dropped off at a house or a business a schedule as to when he would arrive to break in and steal. Coming as a thief teaches the simple idea that there's no advance warning of a specific date. There's a full context in 1 Thessalonians 5 that explains this in detail, which we'll cover later. But the basic idea is, he starts out the chapter saying there's no need to talk to you about dates because you all know he comes as a thief. Which is to say, unannounced beforehand by a date. But he goes on to say how the world in general will be surprised when the Lord returns. But the brethren won't be, because they'll be watching. And what are they watching? The events Jesus outlines in Matthew 24:15 and Luke and Mark that signal the nearness, not the hereness, of his return. And there's a point here to be made about biblical interpretation and deciding truth. We can take a picture or illustration from the Bible and assign to it a meaning, as we've done with coming as a thief. And over time and repetition, convince others that's its meaning, when in fact it may not be at all. So what we really do is give an illustration the meaning we wish it to have to support our views, and convince others that is the meaning of the illustration, and that our view is therefore substantiated by the Bible. In fact, it is not substantiated by the Bible. All we've really done is give a Bible illustration the meaning we wish it to have and ignore the other possibilities. For instance, the 40-year harvest idea that Brother Russell was convinced of. I'm going back to that point. That was never a Bible statement. It was drawn from numerous 40-year stories and interpretive conclusions based on time configurations. So beware, brethren, when an interpretation of a picture or story is presented as a fact of doctrine, it's no more than a human conclusion or interpretation. Another example of this is the fig tree. When we get to that section where Jesus brings that up, you're going to be surprised at Jesus' real use of that illustration. Now, a related point, scare tactics. The witnesses used them well by making brethren think. To leave the witnesses was to leave God's channel and become a candidate for, guess what, second death. How often have we heard similar tactics used as regards daring to study the return of our Lord or daring to come to a different conclusion? I've heard second death mentioned. As we go on in our study of Matthew 24, we will find Jesus most often warning against those who would convince us Jesus is in the desert or some secret hiding place, that he's come when he hasn't. In 2 Thessalonians, Paul spent a number of verses trying to correct the brethren who thought, even then, that the Lord had already returned. But he didn't cast them out of the truth for believing that. He just said he'd talk about it more when he got there. A scare tactic I've heard a number of times. If we don't accept 1874, then we won't know. It's time to come out of Babylon. And woe is us. We won't be the church. This is an extreme example of taking someone's human conclusions based on their interpretation of the hardest book in the Bible and stating emphatically those scriptures about come out of her, my people, mean what they concluded to mean. And their date. And coincidentally, if a certain date is not accepted, you're going to be lost in the pews of the nominal churches. From my perspective, brethren, that has zero to do with genuine Bible study. It is imposing on the Bible human ideas and interpretations with an eye towards scaring others into acceptance of certain given doctrines. What about if our view of what Babylon represents is incorrect? What if the people in it are other than true Christians? What about if all down through the age, real Christians always exited corrupt institutions? History talks about the terrible things done to Bible-believing Christians during the Dark Ages and otherwise. How come they didn't sit tight till the actual time came for them to leave? Would have saved them a lot of trouble. We could go on and on regarding this subject of human interpretation versus what the Bible plainly says. But you get the idea. Next time, Lord willing, we will cover Jesus' answer to the Pharisee question, which is Matthew 24:15-31. We will see Jesus outlines a series of events in sequence leading up to the day and hour of his return in the clouds. And this is a story Brother Woodworth told once. I don't remember if it was to me personally or to a group of us. But Brother Russell once said to a brother, they were having a debate or discussion about the new covenant. This was at the Bethel. And Brother Russell finally says, you know, I've done the best I can to explain it. If you're happy with your understanding, then stick with it. And I think that's good advice from our pastor regarding anything and everything about which we may not be certain, or we may have a variety of views. If we're happy with our understanding, stick to it. And if and when the day comes that the Lord wishes to show you differently, so be it. And if not, so be it. Doesn't matter either way. I do want to express my appreciation for last week's study, which I thought took a lot of humility and integrity, really, for our elder brother Peter to just bring up very simply the thought that, you know, maybe there's something I could understand better about this. I'm not too sure of some things, perhaps, which is actually something you're not supposed to really be doing among us, at least as regards the subject. So I give him all the credit for doing that. And for Sister Judy mentioning also, she wouldn't mind looking into the subject also. And that's really what occasioned me to do this. I hope the Lord will bless this effort and send all of you into the scriptures, looking at this for yourselves and coming to your own sanctified conclusions. And may the Lord overrule all those things said in Aaron. There are always those, brother. There are always those. So may God add his blessing. Thank you for listening. That's the end.